You're with SBS Radio. Find more great stories in your language at sbs.com.au.
Are there any interesting stories from your career that you can share? Maybe some... Yeah.
One always endeavours to settle one's cases if one possibly can, Bertrand. And as I'm sure you know, something like 95% or more of cases settle. Very few cases run to trial, run to judgment. Some cases start and then settle. Some cases run to judgment. I was involved in a case which is on the public record, so I can speak of it, I've done a lot of sexual harassment matters. 99.9% of those settle. This one is known as the Rivers litigation, and this was a case where my client alleged certain sexual improprieties on the behalf of her boss towards her. And during the course of bringing that litigation to trial, we became aware of two other former employees of the same employer making the same complaint some 5 years and 10 years respectively before my client's employment. Now, sexual harassment cases are always word against word. She said, the sexual harassment's not usually conducted in public, as you might imagine. And so when we became aware of these other two complainants, we interviewed them separately from our clients and took what's called a proof of evidence from both of them. And their proofs of evidence were astonishingly similar in the conduct that my client complained about. So we sought and obtained permission from the court to use that evidence from the other two employees to demonstrate the credibility of my client's complaints. Now, this is a technical process. It's very rarely used. It's called similar fact evidence. It's got another name now, but it's essentially called similar fact evidence. It was my view that my client would be believed in any event. She was a very credible young woman. But having obtained this evidence, we thought that we should use it. And similar fact evidence is admitted into the process of the hearing of the matter at the initial stages of the trial, and so that occurred in this instance. So we began this case on the Friday. My client gave evidence. She was cross-examined by counsel for the employer, and then the statements of the other two employees were then put into evidence as documents, and then we went through a process with the court of working as to whether they would be admitted by reference to the evidence that my client had actually given. And the judge wrote a judgment. This was on a Friday. She wrote the judgment over the weekend, and on the Monday she set out in her judgment all of the matters that she was going to admit in our favour to support our client of the content of the evidence of the other two employees to give credibility to our client. And that's in a judgment of the federal court. You can go and look at it. And it was at that point that the employer decided that he wouldn't go any further and the case settled. So that was very unusual, but very exciting and very gratifying process, because it meant that we had a number of other witnesses to call. The case would have gone on for at least another 10 days. if we had to pursue it any further, and we were able to settle it on very good terms, obviously, for my client. I can't obviously say what, but good terms for my client, was most satisfied. So that was a highlight of my, one of the highlights of my career.
Wow, what a successful one.
Yeah.
How do you find those other witnesses? Because
it was sheer luck, Bertrand. It was sheer luck. It was just luck. It just sort of turned up out of the blue. For reasons I can't even now remember how they did, but it was just sheer luck. And they had, didn't, none of them knew one another. They'd been employed at completely separate times. The first one, the oldest employee, she'd been employed there some 10, 15 years before, you know. It was a long time ago, but exactly the same sort of conduct was doled out to her as to my client some 12 months before these events.
And one of the, I think, interesting points that you explained to us, Fran, is the judge's willingness to point out the similar facts and then the way that that encouraged the settlement to occur.
Yes.
So early in the process.
Yes.
I think that would have assisted all the parties, really, but also your own client in those circumstances, to be able to settle the case early rather than wearing all of the difficult emotions and even costs that can go into the full trial.
Matthew makes an excellent point, yes.
And are there any cases where you go home and just keep ruminating these things that is going on? Because we do get sometimes situations you feel, well, have I done enough or should I do this? Are there cases where you go home just can't settle because you feel something, there's a gut feeling that something went wrong or something should be?
Of course, Bertrand. And I don't think any good barrister would not have had that experience on a very regular basis. I always say to my clients in settlement negotiations, if you accept this amount or if you decide to give this amount, if you're giving over the money, you will leave the settlement room, the room where you've signed up to the finalisation of the matter, and on your way home, you will think, I've paid too much, if you're the employer. If you're the recipient, the employee of the amount, you will, on your way home, think, it's not enough. And if that's what you're thinking, it's usually the right amount, in my experience. People always think it's not enough, and they always think they've paid. The other side always thinks they've paid too much.
that's always the case. It's never enough.
No, look, things do go wrong, and this is not a, you know, it's not a perfect game by a long shot, and for lots of people, the risk of losing presents a very important consideration, because they cannot afford to lose, especially individual employees. So the pressure to accept an amount which may not be consistent with their expectations or even their proper entitlements is very great for that reason. And as a barrister, you need to temper that consideration against the complete sellout of the client. I mean, you can't just leave the client accepting chicken feed because, you know, they're concerned about this risk. You have to advise and say, you know, perhaps we might go on to the next step before we accept this amount, take a few more risks, and then perhaps settle at a later stage, without putting their homes or their funds or their person at risk of an award of costs. I mean, I take the view that you must be able to assess a case carefully and realistically so that you don't delude clients into thinking about what the sums of money involved are, and you don't delude them about the risks should they proceed. So if I think something is a loser, I don't have any hesitate in telling people so. And same with employers. If I act for an employer and I think they should pay, I tell them so. And if I think it's a loser for them, I tell them so. And I think that sometimes, I mean, it's my view that employers often take the view that employers often think that they should be told what they want to hear rather than what they need to hear. And that's a proposition that is also true of employees. You have to tell your client what they need to hear, not what they want you to tell them.
And employment law, which is one of your specialties, is an area where I'm always critical on my side. I always think there's way too much power on the side of the employers and less power to the employees. Because as I can see historically how where we're heading, as just an observer of what happens in society, I see that the bargaining power is shifting way too much on the employer's side and less on the workers and employees' side, less to the little people and more to the big boys in society.
You've raised a controversial issue, Bertrand. In some areas, I think your position is true. I'm not suggesting for one moment that employees are in the box position, but it's a controversial area and it's complex, perhaps too complex for me to comment on in this program. Certainly, acting for an employee, they don't have the means to have a big argument. If an employer wants to have a big argument, whether they've got a good case or not, they have the means.
And the time on their side.
They have the means on their side. And good employers settle matters early because they don't want to waste money on lawyers. There's no doubt about that. But you'll get the occasional maverick employee who'll just go for broke and make life hell. But by and large, I'm inclined to the employee's side of your comment. You're probably right. But that's the role of the independent bar, of which I'm a member. We are there to keep the business, the relationship in balance and not have people just run over by overbearing employers. That's our job.
And what are, because you're about to retire, what are your future plans?
Well, everybody will laugh, but I'm the only retiree in Australia who's not going to travel. I'm going to bake cakes, play golf. I'm interested in doing a bit of a course in poetry at Melbourne University. Things that aren't, go to concerts, things I haven't been able to do. I mean, one, as a barrister, one is very, very busy. Going out during the week is very difficult because one has to get up in the morning early and get to court. And so all the things that I haven't been able to do for many years, I'm going to do.
Reading? Cause,
Read, yes. And reading.
What's your favourite book? I'll tell you my favourite book in a moment. It's about lawyers. But what's your favourite book?
I hope you won't think this is too... the most formative book of my career was the book by Simone de Beauvoir called The Second Sex. It was written in 1947 and I obviously didn't read it until well into the late 60s. It was in my local library. I grew up in the country. And when I took it off the shelf and took it to the librarian, because I was still a young woman, 16, I think, I said, oh, I want to read this. She said, oh, I'd have to speak to your mother about that. And my mother was a very broad-minded woman. And she said, oh, yes, that's okay. You can read that. And it was a most it's an extraordinary book now, and I know that when people read it now, young women read it now, they are amazed by it. It explains things. It explained the role of women in the world, and how they could take their role in, take their place in the world, and it was an inspiring book for me.
My favorite books, it's not just one book. I'm a fan of history. And my favorite books that have actually made me get interested in English literature and reading more and more English books, it's about actually corrupt lawyers. Huh. Written by a non-lawyer, by John Grisham.
Yes.
I like reading his stories, and his stories about how people get tricked into legal situations, the way he explained, maybe it's in an American context, but how corrupt the system can be, and how some lawyers can be really unscrupulous.
Well, it's interesting you mention that, because there is a beautiful book that I read recently about, and your listeners, your Aboriginal listeners, community listeners will be interested in this. Marshall was a Supreme Court justice on the Supreme Court of America. Mm-hmm. He was also a barrister for NAPA, which was the African American Association. And he used to be sent to the South in the 40s and 50s to defend black men and women who'd been falsely accused of crimes. And this was extremely common. And, of course, this is redneck country, and if he turned up, he all sorts of things, you know, as he would be driving into town, his car would be shot at. And there was a series of attempts on his life, you know, because he was going all over the South doing this. And someone has recently written a book about those experiences he had, because they were using these cases to expose the corruption of the Southern justice system, and they were taking them on to the Supreme Court of America. So they had to have this brilliant young barrister, effectively, a brilliant young lawyer to make the points at the criminal trials. Mm-hmm. And that was a tremendously inspiring book about how you deal with corrupt legal systems.
Yeah, no, the reason why I like those books is just because you never know how a case is going to end up. There's always a twist. It's like the movies, but the movies are so quick and you miss out on a lot. These ones, there are details, and then, well, you think, like, just like in your case, you found these witnesses who were unexpected. Case solved within a weekend, whereas it could take years and years, and you never know how it's going to end up. It could be the other way or one way or the other. So it's really interesting. Maybe you, Matthew, I didn't let you put in any questions.
That's fine, Bertrand. I can see that you really enjoyed what Fran had to share with us, and that you asked some fantastic questions. So
I just kept talking, and could go on and on and on and on. Well, Fran O'Brien, thank you so much for taking the time to actually pay us a visit Before I just close this conversation, I think it's more appropriate to let you give us maybe a final word to share with us, maybe a word of wisdom to us who are aspiring to achieve what you've realized in your career.
Oh, well, you know, there's that aspiring young Aboriginal community. I mean, look at Deborah Cheatham and, you know, the Eric Avery, the musicians, the Aboriginal musicians. I mean, aren't they fantastic? And we've got some Aboriginal lawyers, and we need more Aboriginal lawyers. So they need to get on their horses and get into the law schools and come and show us how it's done.
Fran, thank you so much for what you've had to share with us today. And I think that your words have been very inspiring, and thank you for the input that you've had in my career, and thank you for all the great work you've done, you know, for many, many people, including Indigenous people and Indigenous communities. It's been fantastic to see your contribution. So.
Thank you, Matt.
Enjoy more stories in your language by visiting sbs.com.au.